Good afternoon. So, last time we looked at reordering, we found out that even though I talked about how we have this guarantee typically that loading and storing things was atomic, that wasn't quite enough to know what our multi-threaded programs would do in a sane way, because both processors and compilers would decide to do those loads at different times than what our code said. And to avoid this, we needed some help from both the processors and the compilers. So we had special instructions for the processors, directives for the compilers. Our typical special instruction in the processors was this memory fence idea, where the memory fence instruction would say, do everything before this instruction, before everything after it, even though you're doing reordering. And that would let us actually reason about what our programs would do. And we learned that things like the pthreads functions would use this special instruction and also tell the compiler, hey, there are other threads involved, don't reorder things yourself. So then after talking about reordering, we looked at how processors actually keep caches in sync when they aren't reordering things. And we had this idea of cache coherency, and we saw a way of implementing that, assuming all the cores have this shared communication medium, which is probably the simplest thing you could do in the hardware. And the key idea was that, you know, write through would be the absolute simplest thing you could do, but that's too slow because we don't want to have every write use this shared communication medium. That will end up being really slow, especially if we have lots of cores. So instead, we're going to do this optimization where if we're writing things that we've already written, we're going to just keep that locally because we'll keep track of the fact that no one else has a copy of that thing. And we'll have to make sure that that's always true. So thinking about cache coherency, we realize that if we're going to make it so for writing a value only one cache has it, this means that if two caches are writing the same value, that's going to happen, be ordered. So one cache is going to write it, then the other. And there's going to have to be some message sent out between the caches on that, making this sort of slower than if we just were writing it on a single core. And for the same value, literally, this doesn't seem like a real problem because, well, if we're writing the same value, of course we want things to take turns. That's a very reasonable idea. But we learned that we get the same taking turns phenomenon when really they're different values, but they're stored in the same place in the cache. They're stored together in the cache in the same cache block. That means that they're actually shared, and we call this phenomenon false sharing, that the values were shared, even though they're really independent values. It's just that the cache didn't have fine enough granularity to figure out that we weren't really sharing information. So then we looked at, well, we have our cache coherency, and we want to get back to the problem of implementing locks. And we wanted some hardware support for implementing locks. And cache coherency told us, well, there's something the hardware can actually do pretty easily, and that's it can let us change a value without other processors getting involved very flexibly, because it just makes sure it's the only core with that value, and we can read and write it without any other core getting involved. So processors export this with these read, modify, write atomic instructions. We saw on x86, we had atomic exchange was one of these. And we saw we could use that to implement what I call the spin lock. So we just use this instruction to try to mark a lock as taken. And while we were marking the lock as taken, also read what the lock was before to see if it was previously taken. And if it wasn't, we marked it as taken, we have the lock. If it was, then we just did a redundant setting, the lock is taken, and we try again. And I also mentioned there are other atomic instructions like compare and swap or fetch and add, which are more powerful than atomic exchange. So there's lots of things processors could provide, and in practice, there's lots of things they do provide. For locks, all we really need is atomic exchange, but if you want to do some more complicated thing, or when you want to implement locks in a maybe more efficient way, you might want one of those other primitives. And we talked about spin locks. So spin locks are locks where, you know, we just keep trying to get it, and we have an infinite loop while we're trying to get it. So our wait for the lock operation in a spin lock spins in a loop, and that's where the name comes from. So before I move on, we start looking at, well, what do spin locks not do that we need to do? Any questions about things we covered last time? Yes?
What do you mean when you say, like, a lock's already taken, and it's redundant to try and make it taken again? So, like, isn't the point that someone else might already have taken that lock?
So in a spin lock, we do an atomic exchange of taken with the lock's value. And if that exchange tells us the lock's value was taken, we just exchanged taken with taken, so we had no change to the memory. But as a result, we learn, oh, someone else has the lock, therefore I can't get it right now. Does that answer your question? Yeah, okay. Other questions? I probably should have repeated that question. Okay, so to mention, we're going to talk about problems with spin locks, and there's a couple things to talk about. So you might say, okay, we have spin locks, that's all we really need, and there's several reasons that's not going to be true. So one reason is that locks aren't going to be enough, that there's going to be things we want to do between threads where locks just don't provide enough functionality. And we're going to talk about that in a bit and give one example of some alternate functionality that we might want. Another issue is that spin locks waste a lot of CPU time. That if we want to run another thread, you know, when we're waiting, spin locks don't do that. If we want that to happen, which we probably do because otherwise we're just wasting time, and worse than wasting time, we're probably not running the thread which has the lock a lot of the time. So we're wasting time delaying the lock from being unlocked. You know, and that's really bad. We want to avoid that. And there's a third problem that spin locks have that we're not going to talk about, is that spin locks, as we've described them, are actually a pretty inefficient way of implementing locks if you have lots of cores because of how that shared bus works. We're going to start with this first problem, that lock abstraction is not powerful. So, like, what are things we'd want to do where locks aren't good enough? Someone give me an example. I assert we've seen things we want to do that coordinate multiple threads together. In particular, in previous cases, we haven't talked about multi-threaded programs, so these threads were in different processes. But there's places where you want to have threads in different processes synchronized where locks wouldn't do the job well. Someone give me an example. So think of things that happened in your shell assignments.
So, okay. There. Could you not guarantee that one process runs after another?
So you want to say guaranteeing that one process runs after another. So I don't know if that's something we have to do in the shell assignment, but indeed, that seems actually a little tricky to do with locks. So with locks, we could say, have a flag which says, did the first thing run yet? But then it seems like the way we're going to use a lock to implement this run the first thing, then the second, is have the second thing, check that flag, get the lock, check that flag, then release the lock, then get the lock again, check the flag, release the lock. That seems horribly inefficient and not the way we want to do that. So we want some way of waiting for something else to run first. You know, so we don't have a way of waiting for events. And that sort of functionality is the big thing we're missing with locks, is that we can't wait for something else to happen. And we had an early example of this. So example I'll give that comes up indirectly in the shell assignment is with pipes. That if a thread is reading from a pipe, it needs to wait for the write to the pipe to happen. And we don't have a good way of mapping this to locks. We want some other sort of operation which says wait for someone to write and don't run me until then. And we don't want to just keep checking, did someone write, did someone write, did someone write, because that's horribly inefficient. And locks don't really actually help us keep checking that in a useful way. So we're going to introduce several other synchronization primitives beyond locks that are going to, in some way, let us wait for other threads to finish something. And I'm going to start with a special one called barriers. And we're also going to talk about these two more general runs. So these are, I'll call general, and the barriers and reader-writer locks are going to be specific cases. So barriers, we're going to see, are going to be about a particular programming pattern that we need something other than locks to handle. And reader-writer locks are going to be about a particular programming pattern that looks kind of like locks, hence the name, but that we need some other sort of primitive to handle well. And condition variables, aka monitors, and counting semaphores, are going to be these very general things we can use to implement locks, or barriers, or reader-writer locks, or any other sort of idea of waiting for someone else, or multiple other threads that we want to do. So I'm going to start with barriers, partly because this is going to come up in the next assignment, which is life. And it's about, the main use case for barriers is about simulations. So let's think about parallel processing. So when I showed you our first examples of threads, we had this idea that we like to be summing up an array. We used a smaller array, but let's say we have a 100 million element array, and I have two CPUs, two cores. So I'll sum up 50 million elements on one core, 50 million on the other, and then wait for all that to finish, and then sum the values together. Now, when we need to do this wait for all the operations to finish, we used typically pthread join. So we need some way of implementing that. And pthread join has the problem that the threads need to exit. And this means that we're starting new threads every time we want to sum up an array, when quite often we don't want to just sum up one array. We want to sum up one array, then another array, then another array. And we really don't want to have to start new threads every single time we do that. So you want some sort of wait for all computations to finish that doesn't involve all our threads exiting. And barriers are going to be a primitive for doing precisely this. So here's our abstract barrier API. So barriers are going to have some initialize operation, which take the number of threads we have doing computations. And there's going to be a wait operation that each thread involves calls, and that ensures that none of the threads finish the wait operation until all the other threads start waiting. And this is really useful for simulations with multiple steps. So in my first example of a parallel computation, we just got a result and we were done. But very commonly, what you want to do is you want to compute one step. So let's say you're simulating the weather. You want to compute what happens in the weather from, 12 to 1201. And then you want to compute the next step using the information from the prior step. But you can't do that until the prior step's actually computed. So barriers are a way of saying, wait for the prior step to be computed before I move on to the next step. So I'll start with the simple case. So we just have one step. So here I'm doing my two sums. So I compute my first sum and my second sum. And then I just chose arbitrarily that thread zero would be responsible for computing the final sum. And because thread zero had this barrier, it's not going to read partial min's element one before it's computed, even though that's computed in another thread. And thread one might go on and compute more partial mins for us later on. If we have like a bunch of arrays, we want this up. Some questions about this code. Okay. So this shows the simplest use of barriers, but what makes barriers really useful is that they can be used multiple times without being reinitialized. So to give an example of our simulation case, so let's say first we compute our initial value, like we read our initial weather, and then we use all the other values to compute the next step. So here results is results time place, for example, and each thread is responsible for a different place. And to know what's going to happen at a particular place, we need to look at everything around it. So we compute the next step from the previous one, and this barrier lets us know, even though I'm reading result 01, and that was computed by another thread, I know it's actually been written and it's actually available to me. Barrier's going to make sure that happens. So we compute that, and we can do this again. So now we can compute results 2 from results 1, and the barrier tells me all the threads have finished computing their results 1. So I can do that, and I can just do this in a loop, and this comes up all the time in simulations. So it's a really useful pattern and a relatively simple primitive sort of synchronization to understand. Not so simple to implement, but pretty simple to understand compared to the much more general ones we'll be talking about later. So questions on what's going on in this example? The question is, does using barriers make the two threads run faster? Absolutely not. But it prevents the problem where, like, we would run all of thread one before thread zero before thread one, like, finished its first computation. And that would mean that, yeah, thread zero ran faster, but it got the wrong answer. Yeah. So the question is, how is barriers.wait implemented? And there are a lot of ways of doing that. So one way is what you describe, you know, just check, is the other thread done? Is the other thread done? Over and over again. So that is a valid way of implementing it. You might hope that if there are other things that could be scheduled on your core, that you wouldn't do that. So there's going to be other implementation techniques. I don't think we'll go into explicitly how barriers can be implemented. We've done that in earlier versions of this course. But we'll talk about things which could be used to implement barriers, and you should be able to figure out a way. And if you can't, there's actually an example in our textbook. So barriers exist in POSIX threads. So there's a pthread barrier t type. It has an init method, which takes an init function, which takes the number of threads, and a wait function. And the life assignment, you're going to have a simulation where the code we give you does this serial thing where we compute the next state from the previous state all in a big loop. And we want you to do that across multiple threads. So if we have multiple cores, it's faster. And that's what the assignment is. And we suggest using barriers to make it so we don't have wrong results from the different cores, from the different threads working in parallel. You don't have to use barriers, but it's almost certainly the simplest way of doing the assignment. Some questions? Barriers. Okay. So now that I've talked about sort of a high-level primitive, let's dive into the second problem, which is wasting CPU time. So spin locks, the way we've seen of implementing synchronization between threads, just uses a lot of CPU time. And to fix this, we're going to want to integrate our lock implementation with the scheduler, because we need threads to have a way of going to sleep and becoming runnable again. So the scheduler needs to know about that. And pthread's mutexes are one of these locks which are going to have some sort of integration with the scheduler. So instead of running an infinite loop while they're waiting for the lock, they're going to eventually give up the CPU, let other things run on the same core. So the lock operation is going to put the thread to sleep, and it's going to add itself to some list so we can figure out later on, oh, this thread was unscheduled, I need to schedule it again. An unlock is going to wake up that thread, you know, wake up in the same way that like a key press might wake up a thread waiting to read something. Now, to implement these mutexes, we still need something like a spin lock. So I'm going to show you how to implement a mutex, but we're going to want to use a spin lock to do it. So we're going to kind of build from our spin lock a better lock. But the reason we're going to want a spin lock is that we have a list of threads that are waiting for the lock, and multiple threads could want to add or remove things from that list at a time. Multiple could add and one removing. And to make sure that that does the right thing, we need to make sure that they do it one at a time, that they take turns accessing that list of who needs the lock next and removing things from it and so on. So we'll use a spin lock to protect that list. Because the spin lock doesn't have any worries about this list. We know it works. And from that spin lock, we'll build this better lock. So our mutex lock operation is going to use the spin lock to edit the list and then unlock that spin lock and just start waiting. Our unlock operation is going to use the spin lock to remove something from the list and then wake someone up based on what you just removed. Some questions about this sort of high-level view of building a better lock from our spin lock. Okay, so let's make this more concrete. So here's my hypothetical implementation. So I'm going to have my spin lock that protects this queue of waiting threads I've called wait queue. And I also have a variable saying whether or not the lock is taken. That's separate from the spin lock. This is about whether the mutex is taken, not the spin lock is taken. And that's initially false. And we have this rule that we're always going to use the spin lock whenever we touch lock taken or wait queue. We're never going to change lock taken or wait queue without having the spin lock locked. And that's going to make sure that we aren't confused about what the value of lock taken is or what threads are on the wait queue, because threads are taking turns and making changes or reading those values. Okay, so our lock taken tracks whether the lock is locked logically, meaning that if I try to lock the lock and I see lock taken is true, I'm going to say, oh, I have to start waiting. If I try to lock the lock and I see lock taken is false, I don't need to add myself to the wait queue. I just set lock taken to true and move on. And our list of threads that are waiting, this is what we're going to use when we unlock the lock to wake someone up who has stopped giving up their CPU. If we don't do that on unlocking, then they'll never get woken up. They'll never start running again. And that means all the threads on this list aren't runnable. Because if they're runnable, we're going to add them back to the list. Or if they're not, if they're runnable, we're going to remove them from the list first and add them to the run queue, the schedulers lists. So here's our pseudocode. So our lock operation, we first get the spin lock so we can safely look at lock taken and wait queue. Our rule is we never touch those without the spin lock. And then we have two cases. If the lock is not taken, we set the lock as taken and unlock the spin lock. We unlock the spin lock because we want it to be the case that if another thread comes along looking for the lock, that it doesn't have to use the CPU while it's waiting. And if we kept the spin lock locked, that's what would happen. So our rule in this spin lock is the reason this is going to be better than just using a spin lock directly is because we're going to hold the spin lock for very short periods of time compared to how long we're going to hold the mutex. And our other case is if the lock is taken, we add ourselves to the wait queue, we mark ourselves as not runnable for the scheduler, we unlock the spin lock, and run the scheduler to give up the CPU. Now, very much unlike our just plain old spin lock, we have a lot more work to do in the unlock case. So in the unlock case, we get the spin lock, and we check if the wait queue is empty. And if it's not, we remove a thread from the queue and mark that thread as runnable. So the scheduler runs it. We don't have to run it right away. Not required. We just need to make sure it's going to eventually get run, doesn't get forgotten about. And in this case, I don't actually set the lock as not taken, because logically, once I've marked that thread as runnable, I've given the lock to it. It has taken the lock now. So questions? Yes, yeah.
Does unlock mutex have some sort of scheduling algorithm unto itself to decide which thread to wake up?
So the question is, this remove a thread from the wait queue, how do I choose which one? And would I have some sort of scheduling algorithm? I absolutely have to make some choice, and that's a scheduling algorithm. The simplest thing would be first come, first served, but you could do something more intelligent, and many lock implementations do. So for example, if you have a priority scheduler, often the lock will choose who gets to run based on priority. Yeah?
Do you need the lock to access the wait queue?
Question is, do you need the lock to access the wait queue? Yes. Like, you need in the sense of for correctness. Like, I could write some incorrect code that accesses the wait queue without getting the guard spin lock, but that would cause problems. Answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So there's one subtlety in this style of lock implementation, which is what happens in between these two lines. And there's a problem here that in between these two lines, I have my thread that's not runnable but could become runnable, because it could be the case that the code here executes in between when I unlock the spin lock and when I run the scheduler. And since this is a little obscure, I'll give sort of a separate timeline for this. So what could happen is thread B has the lock, and thread A tries to lock the lock, discovers it's taken, and adds itself to the list, sets itself as not runnable, and releases that guard spin lock. Because it's done, it started waiting. But the problem is that it can't simultaneously release that guard spin lock and run the scheduler. We have to have some ordering for it. And in the code I showed you, I have chosen that I release the spin lock, then run the scheduler. And if I do that, I have a problem, which is that the thread which has the lock could get really lucky and run right then trying to unlock the lock. And it could dequeue the thread that was just added set it as runnable, and then somewhere it could end up running before it actually gives up core zero. So here I have this problem that I'm running at this point in time, thread A on two cores at the same time with two different versions of the registers. And that's really bad because we don't know which one's correct. And well, in fact, we do. This one is going to be the old version because the thread hasn't saved it. So we need to prevent this from happening. And there's multiple solutions you can use for this. So in Xv6, the solution is that Xv6 is going to hold the scheduler lock from when the thread is set as not runnable until when it's scheduled. So it's not going to be possible for the scheduler to run until on another core until thread A actually goes to the scheduler and saves its registers. So that's the solution Xv6 chose. The solution Linux has chosen for this problem is that Linux tracks separately from whether a thread is runnable or not runnable, whether it is currently on a particular core, and it checks this before scheduling the thread. So it realizes on core 2, wait a moment, that's runnable, but it's already running, let me back out of this. But you need to have something to handle this sort of case. And this means that you're not going to be able to implement this sort of lock without a lot of cooperation with the scheduler. The scheduler is going to need to help you, you know, and give you something a little better than just mark me as runnable or not runnable to make sure it works correctly. Because you need to have that remove operation and the actually running things coordinated correctly. Okay, so questions about this idea, way of implementing a mutex using spin locks and some cooperation with the scheduler? So a nice thing about this idea for implementing a mutex is that it's actually very efficient most of the time. And the reason is that usually we're not going to have contention on our lock. So usually we're going to hopefully set things up so that only one thread at a time actually wants to use the thing that's locked. And in that case, called the uncontended case, and there's not contention about who should have it, this is locking is acquiring and releasing a spin lock and setting a Boolean. And unlocking is acquiring and releasing a spin lock and setting a Boolean, which is pretty fast and notably doesn't require you to even have a system call because you don't need to involve the scheduler. So in the common case, you know, the scheduler isn't involved, but the problem is that in the contended case, when that comes up, you do need to get the scheduler involved. And you need cooperation from the OS. But in the common case, this is just something which doesn't involve any system calls. It's actually pretty fast if you implement it well. Okay. So questions? And pthreads has mutexes. As we've mentioned before. And these are implemented in this sort of style. So I would like to mention at this time that mutexes have a few additional features that are worth knowing about. So one is that there is a thing called error checking mutexes, which will actually return an error if you do things like try to lock a mutex twice in the same thread or unlock a mutex which is not locked. By default, mutexes may or may not do that. Who knows? But if you want to enable that feature because you're worried that you're doing those sorts of things, you can. Also, mutexes can be shared between processes, for example, but by default, that's not allowed. Now, you might say, where would I store a mutex? Like, how do I declare a variable that's shared between processes? Because remember, forking copies it. So we don't know that yet, but we will in, you know, after the midterm. Now, one thing about mutexes, which is a restriction, is that mutexes require you to unlock them in the same thread you lock them in. And I mention this explicitly because if you look carefully at the pseudocode here, there is absolutely nothing in this unlock function which implies that you can't unlock from a different thread. So in this mutex implementation, it would be 100% allowed for you to unlock from a different thread. And some people would therefore come to the conclusion, hey, that's a way I can do things like have one thread wait for another thread. Because unlock is stop waiting, stop someone else from waiting. But unfortunately, you can't do that because pthread mutexes just have a rule that that's not allowed. And the reason why is that the implementation I gave before is not the only way that mutexes might be implemented. For example, it's common for a mutex to, instead of having a lock taken variable, to have a what thread has the lock variable. And if you have that style of implementation, then unlocking from a different thread won't work. Any more questions about mutexes? Okay, so now I'm going to go on to talking more about things that locks can't do. And I'm going to use an example of a synchronization problem, something where we have multiple threads that we want to work together, that comes up all the time. And comes up all the time, not just in the sense that you'll see this case directly, but often there are things where you can make them into this case, and that will be useful because we like have code samples and our book has code samples on how to handle this pattern. And the pattern is that we have a producer and a consumer, and these are two threads. So the producer thread is computing some value or reading some value from somewhere, and the consumer thread is using that value to do something. And we want them to work independently so the producer can run as fast as it wants up to a point, and the consumer can keep running, and we have some buffer of some fixed or semi-fixed size. And the idea is that the producer inserts things into that buffer, the consumer removes things, and we want this to behave correctly if, for example, the consumer tries to remove something and there's not something there, it should wait. And if the producer tries to push things on the buffer and there's no more space, it should wait. So we have two waiting cases we want to implement. And this is something where locks aren't going to be good enough. Because locks, remember, don't give us a good way of wait for something to happen. And in this case, we're going to want to have our producer, for example, wait for the consumer to remove something from the buffer. Also, we're going to have producers and consumers. So one reason we'll use this pattern is I might have like multiple threads on multiple cores computing values at the same time. And so I'll have multiple producers and I want them to all to go to one place, one consumer. And I'll use this pattern to implement that. And one example that's not so obvious where this comes up is a C compiler. So commonly, a C compiler has these different phases. So first we do the preprocessor where we do includes and pound defines. Then we have our compiler, then we have our assembler and our linker. And these can sort of all work semi-independently, but they need the output from the previous phase. And we can use this producer-consumer pattern where there's a buffer in between each of the phases. So we have how much of the file we've preprocessed so far, the assembly code we've made so far, and so on. Just streaming in between as it becomes available. And we do this with a compiler because by running the preprocessor and the compiler and the assembler and the linker all at the same time, that should let us take advantage of multiple cores, for example. Or even on a single core, it will let us do something while the preprocessor is like waiting for the disk. So questions about this pattern? Okay, so I'm going to use this pattern to introduce our first So more general synchronization constructs. So we're not going to have, like for barriers, something which only solves producer-consumer. I'm going to introduce a way of coordinating between threads which can do lots of things, and just start with the example of how do we solve the producer-consumer problem with it. And what I'm going to introduce is what I call monitors, or condition variables. So we're going to use locks with this, but we're going to add something to our locks called condition variables. So our locks are going to handle our mutual exclusion part of the problem. We're going to still want only one thing to access shared resources at a time. So in our producer-consumer example, we want one thread at a time to actually add or remove something from the buffer, but we have this additional case where threads need to wait for another thread to do something, where the producer needs to wait for a consumer to remove a value. So we're going to represent the waiting part with condition variables, but the mutual exclusion, we're just going to use locks that we've already seen. And a monitor is a name we're going to give to something which combines a lock, a condition variable, and some related data, which are just normal data, all together. That's just the name I'm going to give to that combination of things. And this name comes from sort of manifestations of this pattern in object-oriented languages. So for example, in Java, every object has a lock and a condition variable built into it. So every object is a monitor. We have the lock built in. We have one condition variable. They've chosen not to have two or more, though we'll have that flexibility. And instance variables, which are that related data structures. In pthreads, which is what I'm going to show you code for, we're not going to have it be object-oriented because pthreads was written for C. So these aren't going to be directly put together. So we'll just logically have a lock and an associated condition variable or two or three and associated data. There won't be actually necessarily an object that they're all in. Though you could do that. So pthreads is just going to provide you the locks and the condition variables to build this. So let's look at what a monitor's looks like. So I said we have a lock, some shared data, conditioned variables, and sort of in the original manifestation, we imagine this like an object, like in an object-oriented language. So we have some associated operations with like the methods on the object. Our shared data is like the fields of the class. And we're going to have a rule that we have this lock, and we're going to say, you don't access anything that's part of the monitor without acquiring the lock first. So you don't touch the condition variables, you don't touch the shared data without getting the lock first. So we're going to take turns accessing that shared data so we can reason about what happens. Now, when we talked about mutexes, we saw that our lock had this list of waiting threads. So we're going to say, yeah, this lock has a list of threads waiting for the lock. But we mentioned that we wanted to be able to wait for other things other than, like, run me, get me as soon as possible. We want to have threads which are waiting for something else happen other than I can access the data now. Like, sure, I could access the data, but I can't do anything. So, like, if I'm a producer and the buffer is full, I don't want to wait for the lock because if I know the buffer is full, I want to wait for the buffer not to be full. So we're going to have separate list of threads waiting for something to become true, like for the buffer not to be full, attached to these condition variables. And the condition variables are going to essentially be containers for these list of waiting threads. And the name condition variable is actually really bad. Like, from the name, some of you are going to assume, oh, it must have like a Boolean value in it. It doesn't. It's just a list of waiting threads. That's all it is. Like, probably, like, wait queue or something like that would be a better name, but that's not the name that was chosen in history. Sorry. So what's going to be interesting is what operations can we do on these lists of waiting threads? And we're going to have three of them. So one operation is going to be wait. And that's going to take a condition variable and the lock. And it's going to say, I have the lock right now, but I want to start waiting instead. So the thread which calls this is going to be added to the condition variables list of threads that are waiting. And because it previously had the lock, we're going to take the next thing that was waiting for the lock and start running it instead. So this is a combination unlock and start waiting operation. Unlock and start waiting for something else, represented by our condition variable. And if we started waiting, eventually it's going to be the case that some other thread is going to decide, you're done waiting now. We aren't going to decide that because we're waiting, we're not running. But some other thread's going to decide, you're done waiting. For example, I have something for you to read off the buffer. And there's going to be two operations that support that, broadcast and signal. So the broadcast operation says everything that's waiting should start running right now. Or can start running right now, but can't literally start running right away because it wants to access the shared data. And to access the shared data, it needs to get the lock first. So what we're going to do on a broadcast is we're going to say everything which was waiting for that condition now starts waiting for the lock instead. And when the lock is available, they'll get to run. And this means that when we do this wait operation, that wait operation, I said it's unlock and start waiting. So it's unlock, start waiting, and then lock again. So we unlock the lock while we're waiting, but we have it relocked by the time we're done waiting. So you can think of the wait operation as give up this lock until someone tells me I'm ready. But get it back afterwards. Okay? Questions? Seen so far. So there's also a signal operation. And the signal operation is like broadcast, but rather than moving all the threads from waiting on the condition variable to waiting on the lock, we just choose one of them. How we choose that, who knows? There's lots of ways we could do it. We could take the highest priority one, we could choose randomly, we could take the first one, but we somehow choose one and make it start waiting for the lock, leave the others where they are. So the reason we might want the signal operation is going to come up in things like producer consumer, where like if I put a value in the buffer, only one thread's going to find that useful, so I should use signal instead of broadcast, probably. Okay. Some questions? Chris, yeah. So the question, what's the waiting difference between these, our blue threads waiting for the conditions and our red threads waiting for the lock? Threads waiting for the lock are going to be run as soon as the lock is unlocked. Threads waiting for the conditions are only going to be run if some thread decides to run broadcast or signal on that condition variable. And they'll have to wait for the lock for next. Does that answer your question? So like in our producer-consumer example, a thread waiting on the lock, it wants to do something with the shared buffer right now. A thread waiting on the condition variable doesn't have anything to do right now until some other thread detects that it might be ready. So typically, a thread that's waiting on this condition variable, like it looked at, for example, the buffer and said, oh, it doesn't have anything for me, I need to wait for something else to happen. Other questions? And we'll have more concrete examples, which hopefully help with that. So first I'll give a really simple example of using condition variables. And this is with the simplest case I can think of. And this is implementing a wait for finished operation. So we're going to say a thread can finish, and I have a wait for the thread to finish operation. And that's something I want to wait for another thread to do something. So the way I'm going to do this is with my monitor, I'm going to have a lock. I'm going to have some shared data. The shared data is this Boolean variable, am I finished or not? And I have a condition variable, which is the list of threads waiting for me to be finished. So to wait for finished, I get the lock. I check if the thread is already finished. If it is, I'm done. Don't have anything to do. I need to get the lock, so I make sure that I don't check this while it's changing and get confused. Like, I don't want to start waiting and never be woken up because I started waiting too late. So the lock prevents that from happening. And then I wait until that happens, and this wait operation unlocks the lock, so if the thread is trying to finish right now, it can set finish to true and then broadcast to wake me up after I've started waiting. Yeah. And that will work properly. So note we have our standard rules for monitors. So we always get the lock before we touch the finished get variable. That's part of our monitor conceptually. We never look at it without the lock. And we have this check. And this is a pattern you're going to see all the time with condition variables, is that we always double check, do we actually need to wait? And we're basically always going to have to do that. We can't just wait. We can't just assume that it hasn't finished yet. We're almost always going to have to say, maybe it's already finished because I was too slow. So we double check. You might say, why is that a loop? We'll talk about that later. There is a reason. It's not a typo. And then we wait, releasing the lock, so the finished variable can now be set to true, which we just checked and verified it was false. Okay. And we're allowed to proceed later on if we started waiting. And when we're allowed to proceed, we'll check the finished variable again, find out it's not set any, it's set to true now, so I can just return from wait for finished. Some questions? So a timeline for this, you know, in our typical case, wait for finish. Well, this is not a typical case. So like, for example, we wait for finished. We get the lock. Maybe the thread that's finishing finishes at the exact same time. Not a problem. We check if we're not finished. We find out we're not. We start waiting. And then the finished thread sets the flag, wakes us back up, and we don't have any problems actually figuring out that we can return. So here's the case where we're most concerned about synchronizing things correctly, where the two threads are acting at almost exactly the same time. So questions about this timeline? Yeah. So the question is, how does it start running here? The way it starts running here is, remember, the waiting for the condition variable releases the lock. So because it released the lock, it gets to start running. It stops waiting for the lock and gets to run. Yeah?
Once I'm waiting, how does it set finish to be true?
Which thread? How does which thread set finish to be true?
It's like when we finish the previous step, it unlocks the lock.
How does this thread know to set finish to true? The function we're calling is this finish function. So it just hard codes that's what that function does. Okay, other questions? Okay. So here I've shown you sort of the complicated case. We can also have less complicated cases. So let's say we finish before we start running, before we wait. So the thread that we're waiting to finish is really fast. Then it's going to set that to true. It's going to call broadcast, which is going to do nothing because no one's waiting yet. And that's fine. And then we'll check the finish flag, not even wait. Okay. So questions about this? Okay, so I mentioned we had this loop. And you might say, why the loop? We only broadcast if finished is true. So it would seem that the only way conduit is going to return from waiting, the only way we're going to stop waiting, is if finished is true. Why should we bother checking it again with this while loop? And unfortunately, that's not quite true, that's the only way we can stop waiting. If you look at the manual page for pthreadconwait, it has this statement. Spurious wakeups may occur. You might ask, what is a spurious wakeup? And a spurious wakeup means that wait can return even though nothing happened. And you might say, gosh, this is a really inconvenient implementation choice here. Why did they decide to do this? The reason they decided to do this is that it makes some corner cases, it avoids handling some corner cases, which makes the conduit implementation a bunch faster, and they decided that that was worth it. The other reason is that, as we see when we try to do producer-consumer, it's going to be very hard to avoid double-checking the condition in practice, like even if we had the guarantee that there were no spurious wakeups. And we'll see some examples of that later. So questions about spurious wakeups? Okay, so now let's go and look at our producer-consumer problem, and I'll start with a simpler case where I have an unbounded buffer. So the buffer can be as big as I want it. So the only thing I need to worry about is, what if the buffer is empty and this consume function wants to get an item from it, but there's nothing there? So in that case, we're going to need to wait. So we have this, while the buffer's empty, we need to wait. Now, to make this all work with our monitor example, we have some other things going on. And I'll start from the top. So at the beginning of each of these methods, we have a lock. And I said we have shared data. Our rule is we never access the shared data without the lock first. So that's why I lock and unlock before I touch the buffer or use the condition variables. No, this avoids problems. What if two threads in queue simultaneously? Does the buffer handle that? I assume it doesn't here. Okay. And I have this check that while the buffer's empty, I wait. And note that since this is in a loop, I know when I exit this loop that the buffer was empty, not empty, and then I dequeue. And because I have the lock while I'm running this loop, except when I'm waiting, because I have the lock when I'm doing that check, I know that there's no way that the buffer could have become empty from another thread in the meanwhile, because that other thread I know is going to get the lock first, and it's going to have to wait for me to dequeue. Okay. So because of the lock, we know other threads aren't going to sneak in and dequeue after we verify that there's something in the buffer and make our buffer.empty be false. Okay. Questions? Here. So this is our checking the condition, waiting, and then double checking the condition before we actually dequeue. So we know whenever we dequeue, it's going to be the case that yes, we're actually have something to dequeue that's not going to fail, not going to return null or return index out of bounds or whatever. Because we're holding the lock for the entire time between when we're checking empty and when we're dequeuing. On the other side, our produce thread called pthread consignal to tell one consuming thread to wake up. Now, the common case you're going to think of is, oh, there's one consuming thread waiting. It's going to wake up one of them. It could also be the case that no consuming threads are waiting right now, And that's fine. This does nothing, but when that consuming thread comes along, it's going to figure out the buffer's not empty and not even wait. It could also be the case that multiple consuming threads are empty, and we've made the choice to use signal to only wake up one, because we know that if we woke up multiple of them, the first one would say, oh, buffer's not empty, DQ. The second one would say, oh, buffer's empty now, by the time it got to run. So it wouldn't be useful to wake up two. We wouldn't have the wrong answer if we used broadcast, but we'd just be running extra checks of whether the buffer's empty or not that we didn't need to run. Okay, so questions? Okay, so let's talk about this loop here. So how many iterations can this loop run without spurious wake-ups? So give me a number that's possible. There's multiple numbers, give me one possibility. How many times can this loop run? This loop here, this while the buffer's empty, wait. So what is a number of times that loop could run? Yeah.
Zero.
So how could it be zero? The buffer's not empty, we produced before, and there was no one waiting. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a simple case. Produce happens, it signals nothing, consume happens, we find out it's not empty, we wait. And the obvious, more obvious case is that we could have it run once. So we consume, we find out it's empty, we start waiting, we unlock the lock, a produce comes along, which can run now because we've unlocked the lock, and queue signal stops us from waiting, and when it unlocks the lock, we get the lock, find out it's empty. So how about two or more? And you might think, well, we shouldn't have more than two iterations other than a spurious wake-up. And there are good reasons to think this, and to talk about how this works, I need to talk about two different ways of implementing condition variables. So there are two styles of condition variables. And in one of them, this is going to be possible. So here's two or more iterations without a spurious wake-up. And I have three threads, which is why it's not obvious, right? I needed a third thread to make this happen. So I produce in one thread, and it signals my thread, my main consume thread. So I have one iteration, and I stop waiting, but when it unlocks, someone else was waiting for the lock first that was consuming, and they go first, and they take off what was enqueued. So we have our enqueue matches up with this DQ, so we wait a third time, a second time, even though we were woken up. And you could rightfully say, gosh, it seems really broken that this signal can wake up thread two, but the unlock can wake up thread three. Why is that happening? And you might say, maybe that shouldn't happen. And that's a reasonable thing to say. This is not what POSIX has decided. POSIX has decided that the locks are not going to necessarily work, be coordinated with the condition variables, so this is very possible. Questions about what's going on here. So you see that the lock we just gave to whoever was trying to get the lock first, and that meant that even though we signaled and woke up a particular thread, it's not the one which got the lock first. Yeah. So the question is, are two consume threads on the queue for locks at the same time? Yes. So right here, in this example, there are two threads. So actually, right here, you know, when it's in queuing, there are two threads on the queue.
Do they both put there at the same time, or is one already there?
So in this example, the thread two, the question is, were they both at the same time? Thread two was put on the queue. Thread three was put on the queue here, and thread three is put here. Does that make sense? So thread 3 was put on the queue because it was running this lock. And thread 2 was put on the queue because of this signal in another thread. And the problem is that the signal didn't mean you got put on the queue first, even though that's what you were probably thinking intuitively would happen. I just woke it up, it should run. But that's not what happened because there was something else to run, and the scheduler decided to run the something else, or the lock implementation. Okay. Questions? Here, yeah. So the question is, what is a spurious wake up, how does a spurious wake up interact with like being signaled? So a spurious wake up means that there's another possibility that we could just like randomly, for no reason, I'll do the different color, we could wake up thread 2 right here, even though nothing happened. That's what a spurious wake up means. Spurious wake up is no discernible reason for it to happen. It's allowed to happen. And the reason it would happen in practice is that the conditioned variable implementation might do something sloppy. Like it might make an approximation of is someone waking me up or not that doesn't always isn't correct in some corner cases. And the decision that POSIX made is that they're allowed to do that if it makes things faster. Does that answer your question? So this issue is not a spurious wake up, but it's an issue that we have decided that signaling is separate from getting the lock next. So there are two styles of monitor implementations. So there's what's known as Hoare style monitors, where what I just showed you is not possible, where signaling a thread hands off the lock next, that we guarantee that if we wake someone up with a signal, they run next, they get the lock next. And there's Mesa-style monitors where signaling just as you should a list of people waiting for the lock, who knows if you get it next. And you might say, gosh, this Hoare style seems really useful. I'd sure like to get a pthreads library which does that. I'm sorry, I do not know of any threading implementation on current systems that does it, even though historically it has been common. There might be someone like embedded or something, but it's not actually easy to find. Yeah.
Is the only difference that the signal enqueues it to the front of the queue?
Question, is the only difference that the signal enqueues it to the front of the queue? Yes, conceptually, that is what the difference is. Yeah, and I should say, the reason why, like, POSIX might not do this, a reason why POSIX might not do this is that the actual implementation of the mutex might not have an obvious queue. At all the time. Yeah.
Can you go back to the last slide?
Yes.
So, like, just to make sure I understand this, the third thread ends up being able to dequeue because, like, the producer signals and it stops the wait, and then, like, the unlock happens, and then simultaneously, like, thread 2 or thread 3 can, like, acquire the lock, and then...
Like, so the question is, yeah, so in this scenario... Thread 2 or thread 3 can acquire the lock after the wait is stopped. Yeah, so that's what the scenario is. So I guess maybe a thing which is not so obvious is stopping the wait doesn't just says you start waiting for the lock now in this model. Right, in all the models. So stopping the wait means you start waiting for the lock. You're still waiting. You're just waiting for something else. And the question is, what's the order in which we resolve conflicts between multiple people waiting for that thing. And in this scenario, we're saying that you don't get preference because you were waiting for the condition variable. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So I showed you our unbounded buffer, and we can add the constraint I started with originally, which was a bounded buffer. So that's where instead of having I produce an unlimited number of things, I want to say if I produce a million values, let's stop and let people catch up and use those values before I run out of memory. So to implement that, I'm going to say I'm going to just add a little things and a little bit of code to handle the case of what if the buffer is full. And this is the sort of reason why, you know, I like condition variables as a way to implement coordinating between threads, because I can sort of build this up incrementally. So here is the code I've added to my unbounded buffer implementation to make this work. I added, if the buffer is full, wait in the producer. So that's just sort of a mirror image of what I had for the consumer. And when I dequeue something from the buffer, I signal a producer. And I have a separate condition variable because I have one list of threads waiting for things to be added to the buffer, one list waiting for things to be removed. Presumably, they're not both in use at the same time. And I just add this incrementally. And if I have more things I need to wait for, I can just keep adding to this. Questions? Oh, here? Yes.
Is it possible to design your condition variables in such a way where you get like a deadlock?
The question is, could I get something like a deadlock? And the answer is not because of how the condition variable works itself, but I can certainly have cases where I never actually signal or broadcast my condition variables. We'll talk about that more when we talk about deadlock, which will next week. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So another thing about how condition variables work is that here I'm signaling, because I know only one thread cares when I add an item, only one thread cares when I remove an item, but it would be correct and slower, but correct, I wouldn't get wrong answers if I always broadcast. So that's sort of an advantage of condition variables, that if you don't know, is it right to signal here, you can broadcast, and at least you won't get the wrong answer. Things might just run a lot slower. And another thing I could have done, which is sloppy, is that if I replaced all the signals with broadcast, I could just have one condition variable. So I could have just combined these into a ready condition variable, broadcast on ready, saying someone's ready, why don't you all figure out if you're ready? And that would be correct code. It would be slower than I want it to be, probably, but that would be a correct implementation that I'm allowed to do. And because that's correct is probably why Java have this idea that they'll have a lock and a condition variable built into every object, because it's enough, and you can do extra stuff if you want it faster. Okay. So with that in mind, here's our general pattern for using monitors, is that you're going to get a lock, because you never access anything used you're using without a lock. Always lock first. And then you have something you wait for, and you wait for that to be true with a condition variable corresponding to every sort of thing you want to wait for. Like, you could combine the multiple things you wait for, but probably it's faster not to. And then you change the data, and you check for everything that someone else might care about if you actually changed it. So they might want to start running, and if so, you broadcast to make them start running. Or alternately, you signal if you know only one thread can possibly care. So that's our general pattern for monitors. So you see, and I have these rules of thumb here. So I'll talk about these. So never touch data without using the lock, and you hold the lock for the entire operation. You don't like check if the buffer is full, unlock, lock again, entire time, so no one can sneak in. And you have this loop while you're waiting for a condition using one condition variable, and you have corresponding code that says, if I change that condition, broadcast or signal, and so on. And we saw the API. I'll just have this up here. You could probably have guessed this from what we saw with pthreads earlier. This is how you use it with pthreads. And then there's signal and broadcast, which you've already seen.